नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So today is the observance day, and our custom here is to, if you have the energy, to practice through to 12 o'clock. So it's a chance to do formal practice for a longer stretch of time. And in our life too, as monastics, we have, I was thinking of the times we have, think about it, we finish the meal at 12 o'clock. And the next duty is actually 5 o'clock in the morning. So that's 17 hours of potential formal practice. You have to sleep and all that. And then 2 days a week there's no work schedule. So really encourage the monastic community to look at those times and see it's a good opportunity to do long stretches of practice. And to try to use that time intelligently and wisely. What we call practice, well, it depends. It's not just formal sitting. Sometimes it's just working mindfully, making a bowl stand or sewing robes is practice too. So it's not necessarily the posture, but it's that intention to be present and focused and do whatever we do to do it well and not to be distracted. So the opportunity is there. Really, it's a very, very good opportunity, and keep that in mind. So if perceptions come up that it's that you're busy, that's your mind, it's a very, very liberal schedule. There's a lot of space for practice. And that's, of course, only possible because our lay friends are so generous. And Jane is in the kitchen cooking away furiously, and so on and so forth. So it's always good to remember that as monastics we have this duty to take the teachings of the Buddha wholeheartedly and honor the dana that's given to us with gratitude, and then also with the determination to realize the goal. And the realization of the goal is the reason we do talk about renunciation. If one doesn't keep in mind the whole point of the Buddhist teaching, then renunciation can be misunderstood, at the very least. So which way you take the teaching is, you could take it, the Buddha says, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. Take that. There is the uncreated, the unconditioned, the unoriginated, the unborn, the deathless, Nibbana, the island, the harbor, peace. If there were not the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unborn, Nibbana, the harbor, and peace, there would be no release, no liberation from the conditioned, from the born, from birth and death. That's another way you can take it, you can put it. So renunciation, Buddhist renunciation, monastic renunciation, or just the idea of renunciation in Buddhism comes from the fact of the Buddha's realization. And then he offers that teaching, offers the teaching so that we can have that, that we aspire to that realization ourselves. So renunciation is in the context of the Buddha's realization. It's just not an abstract. It's just not saying that sensuality is bad or that it's evil to enjoy yourself. These would be sometimes in Western culture that has been taught, that somehow it's bad, that sensuality is bad in some kind of way. Absolutely, it's not absolutely bad, it's just distracting. So renunciation, if your aspiration is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, then it becomes a very logical, very easy conclusion, actually, that attachment or fascination or pursuit of the conditioned, the form, the structure, the constructed, the fabricated, that which is born and dies, fascination with that or preoccupation with that is a misadventure. it's looking in the wrong place. It's focusing on the wrong thing. So if you see that, that's the logical conclusion, has to be non-grasping or non-confusion by or non-preoccupation, maybe non-preoccupation with that which is conditioned. And so what is conditioned, the Buddha lays it out as the five khandhas, or as the, you might say, the modern parlance, what would you say? You say the physiological and psychological or conditioning, mind-body experience, different ways. But we talk about the five khandhas, so things of the body, vedana, sanya perceptions, sankhara mental formations, sense consciousness, these are the khandhas. And we, so in our morning chanting, we chant the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. So the end of dukkha is the non-grasping of the khandhas. So that's our philosophical, or that's our analytical base that we come from. And if you really, if you think about that very, very carefully, then you'll see that the problem is not the khandhas themselves, it's not the body, it's not the emotions, it's not mental formations, it's not sights or sounds, that's not the problem per se, it's rather the grasping of it or the attachment of upadana. So we have the word upadana, or grasping or attachment. So renunciation then is helping us, and renunciation isn't just for monastics, it's a whole attitude. Whole attitude of our spiritual practice. It's a whole attitude which sees the futility of constantly being preoccupied with the khandhas, and yet does not doesn't say it's bad or wrong. So it doesn't say that comfort is wrong, or that beauty is wrong, or that sweet things are wrong, or that excitement is wrong. It's not that. But the constant preoccupation with the exciting, with the interesting, with the fascinating, with qualities, with experiences and all that, that preoccupation precludes the possibility of being available to the unconditioned. It's just not possible. So renunciation, then, say something like our monastic life is a life of celibacy where we don't have intimate relationships with people. So intimate relationships are fine, and this culture, of course, praises intimacy, the kind of popular culture, but I think we all know that intimacy involves a lot of preoccupation. Sometimes it can be wholesome and uplifting, sometimes it can be very entangling. So our life as monastics then is a life of renunciation where because we live celibate and the emphasis is not on intimacy, it's more like aloofness actually, that gives a certain amount of freedom. It also creates the craving for that, creates the desire for that. It doesn't create it, but it more highlights that. So when we feel lonely or when we feel bored or something, then the heart can very much yearn for intimacy or relationships or sexuality or whatever it is. And then the challenge is, of course, to see that yearning, to observe the unfulfilled desire rather than pursue desire. And this is renunciation. Not because one rejects that or says it's wrong, but because we realize the pursuit of desire is always the pursuit of objects. And objects are conditioned. They're conditioned, they're born and they die. And so renunciation comes from wisdom, comes from right understanding, not from rejection, not from saying these things are wrong. It's not a negative, it's actually a alternative direction in one's life, an alternative use of one's energies and one's what one pays attention to. So then, very real feelings of living monastic life, living a celibate life, can be feelings of loneliness, feelings of boredom, and those are just khandhas. They are just part of the khandha structures. And you can, you can see that being able to witness something like loneliness and not seek a compensation, to look at the desire to get rid of it, but actually bear witness to loneliness as a khandha as a condition that arises, endures, eventually ceases. If one can do that, then what happens is the desire structure falls away. Awareness is strengthened, awareness of change is strengthened, and one then inclines towards the unconditioned. Whereas the other is, as soon as there is a loneliness or some kind of negativity, one seeks the compensation. That's not wrong, but that whole structure oftentimes never really addressed. So that's what we sometimes mean by rebirth. Well, it doesn't mean that it's not possible to have spiritual relationships and uplifting relationships and so on, but say as a monastic community, the Buddha recommends keep it simple, keep it very simple. But simplicity isn't actually pleasurable. Simplicity can be quite painful sometimes. So it's not simply some kind of aesthetic. I prefer simple architecture or a simple room. It's much more profound and challenging than that. So our containment within the Vinaya, the language of renunciation, is one that inclines us towards the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, and the unformed. Whereas the desire for the conditioned is always the entrapment, the complexity, the engagement with, the preoccupation with the conditioned realm. And so as renunciants, and any of us who, when we're faced with the challenge of not getting what we want, and the challenge that when you get what you don't want, or you can't get what you do want, that's very, what happens to the heart when it can't get what it wants? It manipulates the world usually in a way to try to just get what I want. I want something, so I'll organize the world, I'll speak to people, I'll lobby, I'll manipulate, whatever, so I can get what I want. Or the other, when one gets something that one doesn't want, then the energy is sort of to preoccupy, to get rid of that. And a certain amount of that is necessary, certainly. But preoccupation, always with desire, precludes the possibility of realizing the unconditioned. So the teaching then is always pointing to dukkha, and the cause of dukkha, and the cause of dukkha is attachment to desire. So the khandhas are not, and there's nothing wrong with the khandhas, they just are as they are. There are forces in nature, bodily things, and mental things, and emotional things, social structures, such like, nothing wrong with it. So grasping is the real challenge to understand upadana. What is that? What does that feel like? And upadana, if you follow the paticca-samuppada formulation, springs forth from tanha, from craving. So with contact is condition, there's craving. With craving is condition, there's upadana, grasping. With grasping is condition, there's becoming, there's being, there's a whole sense of birth. So to observe unfulfilled desire is terribly uncomfortable. It's not fun, it's not easy. But in the observing of that, and there's something particularly powerful about like negative things that we might experience, disappointment or discontent or pain in the body, these things, if they're not too harmful, there's something particularly edifying about them. Because the conventional and worldly way of dealing with something like disappointment is to blame, to distract, to seek a compensation, to do something else. And so that reinvests belief in objects, reinvests a belief in khandhas, reaffirms one's commitment to rebirth, to conditionality. Whereas when one is able to see disappointment, unfulfilled desire, frustration, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and actually hold attention on that, rather than just figure out how to manipulate the world to get what you want, when you can really look at unfulfilled desire, you begin to not be so preoccupied with the object of desire, you begin to really look at desire itself as the object of awareness. And if that's witnessed to, when you see that movement out, away from it, to get what you want or get rid of what you don't want, and that very movement, that struggle with our conscious experience of the khandhas, that very struggle is like is the is where that kind of forbearance and witnessing of monastic life is so important. So you witness something like disappointment or disillusionment or sadness or loneliness, and you hang in there, you bear with it, you watch it, you witness it as change. So the perception of change is very important. And if one trusts and has faith in that, then eventually it has to cease. It has to cease. And in the ceasing, you begin to get a taste of what the third noble truth is, the cessation of desire. Not as an absolute, but as now, as an existential experience. That's what it's about. And that's particularly, there's something particularly powerful about negative experiences, negative feelings, say, that when we can bear witness to them, there's a lot of strength, a lot of barmi, a lot of insight comes forth from that. Because our habit is not to bear to that. Our habit is more to blame ourselves, others, read a book about why you're suffering, or something like that. So we go to intellect, we go to emotional compensations, to sensual things. As monastics, actually, we have very few avenues for that. Sleep, maybe. Crash out, and I like the mind with sleep, stay busy. Something. So it's a very mature undertaking that we're involved in, very mature in the sense that one is now willing to just bear with whatever's there. So sometimes life is okay, samadhi's okay, health is okay, and it sort of ticks along, and everything's going well, and then falls apart. Some difficult emotions, some disagreement in the community, some sense of failure, sickness, and all of a sudden you get what you don't want, or you lose what you wanted. You know? And that's the challenge, that's the real challenge. So in monastic life, it's one of the things that we're not demanding of each other is that we're happy all the time. You don't ordain, thou shalt be happy to keep the abbot happy. That's not how it works. And certainly me as a senior monk, when I see someone unhappy, I think, how can I help them? But that's not my job, is it? And my job is, bear with it. Witness it, be brave, watch and bear witness to the difficulty. And all our masters, you read Lumpo Cha, the stuff he went through, Lumpo Sumedho, a lot of challenges and difficulties and so on, the things they get through, they're not pretty, and they're not easy, they're very, very challenging, but the kind of mature, manly way to deal with it as in our form is okay. If this is what's come up, I will bear witness to this too. I'll practice Kanti Barami with this, rather than projecting or distracting or blaming oneself or others. So it's very mature that way. So if things do come up, when things do come up, try to maybe see that there's a great strength in having a difficult time if one has that attitude of, okay, this is just a condition. It's just a condition, that's all it is. So the use in Buddhism of perceptions is very important. If you look at the way the teaching is laid out, there's a lot of emphasis on how we interpret life. And we interpret life through perceptions. So I perceive this is water, I'm thirsty, I drink it. I know it's water. I know that's a cup. I know that's a tape recorder. I don't drink the tape recorder. I drink the water from the cup. I don't drink water from this. This is a spittoon. Someone might have spit in it. So I know. So my perceptions are a necessary part of life. I know that's a clock. I know those are my glasses. That's softer. This is harder. And so forth. So perceptions are a necessary part of our existence. But what happens if your perceptions are warped? What happens if your perceptions are inaccurate? What happens if your perceptions are biased? What happens if your perceptions are tinged by deluded agendas? Then, of course, the whole thing doesn't work. It doesn't work because perceptions are filled, informed by ignorance. And so the basic perceptual structures that the Buddha challenges us with is perceptions of self, I am this body, I am these emotions, this is my personal history, I was born and I will die. Those are perceptions, those are interpretations. And the Buddha's radical take on that is that certainly the body is born and dies. The body has the nature to decay. But this is not me, not mine, not myself. And that's a perception. That's a different kind of perception. So the way I try to use that anatta reflection is this is happening in awareness. So if I do that, this is happening in awareness. It's just a word, you know, it's not an absolute. It's not to say awareness is an absolute, but if I just do that as a perception, this is happening in awareness, then there's a tendency just to know this as a condition, as an object that's changing, arising and ceasing. When I take it personally, then of course there's the enmeshment with it, the attachment to it. So one of the things about renunciation is to see that that which has a nature to arise is a nature to cease and is not self. So renunciation all involves a correct perceptual interpretation of our mind-body experience. And that's very radical, because everyone identifies with their body, identifies with their emotions, identifies with their personal history. And now what we're trying to do is just to see that emotional content is certainly conditioned, it's certainly personal, in a sense it's individual, but the awareness of that is not a person. The knowing of that is not a person. It's simply knowing, sati sampajanya, intelligence, whatever you want to call it. And the adopting of that attitude, that this has a nature to rise, a nature to cease. This is in awareness. The body's in awareness. Sound is in awareness. Depth perception is in awareness. Personal history is in awareness. Always in the present moment. That's a practice. That's not a belief. If one takes that as a belief, then it's just a kind of religious artifact, a Buddhist artifact, Buddhist condition. So it's not just believing. It's not a philosophical position what we're taking either, as some kind of, you know, the Buddhists believe in not self and Christians believe in God, something like that. It's not the point of it. It's rather a very alive interpretation of the way things are. So it requires investigation. You can investigate, okay, where is the sense of self? And of course it just slips through your fingers all the time. So a perception as a practice, as opposed to a position. A perception is an alive interpretation, continually reinvigorated through one's readings, through one's contemplation. It's constantly invigorating that. So to actually practice anatta, perception of anatta, or anicca sanya, anicca, the perception of anicca, takes a mind which is always goes to that way of interpretation. So to interpret or relate to, let's say, if I have some kind of a, maybe I make something and then it, I'm doing some picture framing or something like that. So I'm doing some picture framing and I get some really nice molding. I got some nice molding when I was in Toronto. Me and Curtis went to my favorite molding shop. Really lovely golden contoured molding. This stuff's very expensive. So then I see the picture and I measure it all out and I cut it too short. Absolute disaster. You know, it's like cutting diamonds for me. Now that's what an absolute disaster feels like. And the feeling is terrible, it's disappointing, right? So what do you do with that? You say, I'll never do framing again. Or you blame yourself or whatever. But you say, no, life is this way, life is disappointing. It feels this way. Huh? This is a feeling of, you know, botching something or breaking something. And it's life is disappointing. And then you perceive that through anicca, or you perceive that in the context of this is taking place in awareness. That's alive, that's an alive practice. It's not a dead belief. So the frustration of ruining the material rises in the mind. Oh God, you're dumb, you're wasting the Sangha's money. And no, and then, that habit of self-disparagement comes up, but now I just try to perceive that through a relationship of this is changing. And that's something you have to make alive in your mind. Or this is happening in awareness. Awareness is like conscious space. And this is arising and ceasing. So conscious space is just a word. It's not, no, I'm not taking philosophical positions here. Sometimes people get confused and they're, oh, you believe that awareness, and I don't believe anything, I'm just practicing. So the perception of this is happening in awareness is a part of non-grasping. Or the perception that they relate to an experience through the perception of change, that takes a certain kind of distance, aloofness, wisdom, sati sampajanya, mindfulness and quick comprehension. And that's a doing. That's a very alive doing. It's not passive. It's not getting rid of. It's not being willful in some kind of averse way, but it's a very alive attentiveness to the way things are through the Dhamma, through the perception the Buddha's asking us to consider. And then if we train in those perceptions, if we actually train in those ways that the Buddha's asking us to perceive life, then what happens is that that interpretation is in line with the way things are. This is Dhamma. And that inclines us to the unconditioned, because we're no longer identifying with the conditioned. We're no longer seeking our solace or refuge in the conditioned realm of objects. That's no longer the project. The project is non-grasping. So this is a form of renunciation. To give up self-identity is a form of renunciation. Now, you don't give up responsibility, still morally, ethically, as a monastic, according to the Vinaya, we still have responsibility. So within responsible social living, within responsible ethical living, there can be the practice of anatta, of anicca, to allow the perception that's happening in awareness within the framework of our Vinaya responsibility. Otherwise it wouldn't work. Dukkha, the analogy I've been using all through, I was in Toronto just teaching here, I kept coming back to this simple analogy that, you know, we when we read the chanting is printed on the page, and we follow the chanting, we get confused by the chanting, we like it, we don't like it, we flip to the next page, we'd rather have the English, no, we like the Pali, we can't follow the Pali, but all the time our attention is on the print and on our voice. And so the analogy for dukkha or unsatisfactoriness is that we fail to look at the page itself. We don't notice the page, we notice the print. But all print is conditioned. And so the idea of the page as analogy is it's the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unborn. So the contemplation of dukkha lakana, not dukkha vedana or dukkha sacca, the contemplation of dukkha lakana, the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory when we consider transcendence or the unconditioned. So all conditions are unsatisfactory in that sense. The characteristic is unsatisfactory. So you get this kind of paradox that happiness is unsatisfactory. And if you don't understand where that's coming from, you think, this is silly. It's not true. Happiness is happiness. But it's unsatisfactory because it's still conditioned. So dukkha lakana, the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness, you begin to see, yeah, it was a good read, but it's not the page. Otherwise, we're always editing. You know, we're always looking at the print and editing all the time, then we go to another book. And that's what happens with the attachment to the khandhas, is there's a constant editing, analyzing, and preoccupation with body, mind, feelings, emotions, relationships, and there's a seeking for the right text, as it were, but that's the whole project is wrong. because we're looking for the satisfactory in the unsatisfactory. We're looking for the unconditioned in the conditioned. It can't work. It's not possible. We're looking in the wrong place. Looking for a turtle with a mustache, as Ajahn Chah would say. And so dukkha, you know, dukkha is that there's just this deep sense of renunciation of all conditioned phenomena. And not, again, not rejecting comfort or preferences in tea or coffee or enjoying good company. You know, it's not so much a rejection, it's like realizing the limits of that, realizing the limits of relationships, the limits of bodily health, the limits of constructed forms of samadhi, the limits of all that. They can be useful, friendships can be useful, samadhi is useful, good body is useful, and so on, and one wishes all the best for. But just to realize that this is, that's not a refuge. The conditioned realm is not a refuge. Can't be. Because it's born and dies. It arises and ceases. It's constantly slipping through our fingers. So this is not a, it's not like a theological rejection of happiness. That, you know, it's bad to be happy and it's evil to enjoy yourself, and sex, drugs, and rock and roll are evil. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll are not evil. They're just limited. You cannot find the unconditioned in the conditioned, that's all. And so there's a kind of, the renunciant mind then inclines, well, to other aspirations. It's a different kind of aspiration. So what happens with the renunciant mind, when there is beauty, when there is comfort, when there is good companionship, there's more and more sense of gratitude. Oh, yeah. But then when it changes, there's more sense of Dhamma. Oh yeah, it's supposed to change. Like Ajahn Sumedho's line that I love, he says, we were having a frappuccino in Seattle, in a Starbucks in Seattle. Me, him, and Ajahn Panyasara, Lompol, some lay people, very happy time. Very warm and convivial, and this delightful drink. And Lompo says to me, "Viradhammo, this is a peak moment." And, you know, so you kind of realize, yeah, sometimes there is a peak moment, it all comes together, but then it changes. And sometimes I think from, you know, Western theological ideas, it's something bad, these things are bad. It's not so much a bad, they're limited. So they're dukkha in a sense, they're unsatisfactory in terms of that which is satisfactory. And the Buddha said, you know, from his realization. So then renunciation starts to bring up this willingness to endure the unendurable, to begin to practice sense restraint, to limit the movement into sense happiness, not because it's wrong, but because it is addictively distracting. And that's a different attitude. So the limitations on distractions around computers or any kind of sensuality, the whole sense of following one's appetites becomes absurd. And whereas consumer culture is just saying, if you keep following your appetites, you'll be fulfilled. Buddha's saying, you follow your appetites, you're just going to be more hungry. You'll be a hungry ghost. And so the whole sense of one's appetite, you begin to see those as conditioned phenomena. And there's a kind of, sometimes it's almost like a cold turkey experience of just having to bear with the non-fulfillment. Not in a way of hurting yourself, but just as a natural kind of inclination. So as monastic community, you find monks are like challenging themselves around sleep patterns, challenging themselves around food, very, very simple things, or just different kinds of minimal distractions. Challenging, okay, what if I don't have that? What if I don't do that? What if I do this more? If I'd walk and sit more? A kind of manly challenging. And that comes from not just like willfully trying to get something, but saying, well, how can I be with unfulfilled desire? So I know my I was showing Venerable Suvijana some pictures that I managed to keep from my early days in Thailand, and there's one picture there where I'm very, very thin, and I was a salmon era then, and it was a kind of half cave. It was a platform in a kind of cave overhang that was my kutsi, and very, very simple, like really one meal a day and no coffee, no tea, no books, nothing. Just one meal a day was the only kind of sensual experience you had, except for the heat and the coolness of the cave. So the normal, natural sensual experience. So there's absolutely no distraction. And Venerable Suvijana was saying, "Oh, you were very lucky to live in those times." And I think about, yeah, I was really fortunate to live in such utter, utter simplicity, where there was nothing except whatever my mind wanted to produce with the way things were. Well, there was a straw mat on the floor, and there was water, of course, there were those things. But really, from what I had been used to, from my Western cultural background of things to compensate and distract, there's really nothing there. I remember one of the really frustrating moments was when I had a dictionary, and I found that I went away for a week somewhere. Came back and the termites had eaten half of it. That was the dictionary I had. It was something intellectually stimulating. Termites had eaten it. And so that simplicity, it's you can't really reproduce that now without being terribly forceful, and it would be too contrived. I think that's the word, would be too contrived. But so each of us in the monastery needs to find our own simplicity, our own sense of non-distraction within a more complicated situation, more complicated society. But do contemplate what is renunciation? What is it? What is that nekama barami about? Well, why simplicity? Why not complexity? Why celibacy? Why not relationships? Again, it's not a negation, it's not speaking against these things. It's just saying, no. The aspiration for nibbana is the aspiration that is helped by simplicity, that is aided by these different suggestions that Buddha made. And then the cultivation of perception. How do we use perception? What is that as an active force in our practice rather than a static belief? And that's very important. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayantamagataya sadhu karangadamase.